patients, say in toddlerhood or early childhood, will start to trip and fall unusually. So they may be running normally, and then they'll start to become a little bit clumsy. And so that's a sign that the motor skills, you know, are starting to be affected. There are challenges with swallowing, which again, these will get progressively worse without intervention.
I'm Jonathan Alisea, and you're listening to the Rare Disease Report. Niemann-Pick disease is a rare lysosomal storage disorder affecting one's ability to metabolize fat. Divided into different types, Niemann-Pick A, B, and C, the inherited disease is heterogeneous in its manifestations. Even more, it can present at various stages of one's life, with many going undiagnosed for years. The tune is the same as other rare diseases. There are no curative options. It may be managed, but the disease is lifelong. Research has largely been unsuccessful in the search for therapeutic options, but that may soon change. In a recent conversation I had with Dr. Sharon Ringo, Chief Scientific Officer and Senior VP for Medical Affairs at Cyclotherapeutics, she discussed the promise of an investigative agent for patients living with Niemann-Pick C, the most common of the three types. She explained the clinical trial program surrounding the agent, as well as the current treatment and research landscape for Niemann-Pick and Niemann-Pick C. She also highlighted the challenges that patients face on a daily basis, noting in particular the neurological and peripheral symptoms of the condition. Since Niemann-Pick can present so differently between patients, it can be difficult to describe a typical experience. Nevertheless, as Dr. Ringo noted, it is the hope that future research and educational opportunities can help improve the lives of patients of all types and symptoms. We covered a lot of ground, but remain committed to one goal: bringing you the most up-to-date and accurate Rare Disease Report. Make sure to subscribe to the Rare Disease Report on your favorite podcasting platform, and follow us on Twitter at RareDR, and on Facebook and LinkedIn. Enjoy. Well, Dr. Ringo, thank you so much for joining me today on the Rare Disease Report. I'm happy to have you here.
Jonathan, thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to the discussion.
No, me too. And today we're going to talk about Niemann-Pick disease. Can you just tell me a bit about yourself, what your work has looked like over these past years, and what brought you to Niemann-Pick disease, and we'll go from there.
Sure. I'm currently the Chief Scientific Officer and Senior Vice President for Medical Affairs at Cyclotherapeutics, but how I've gotten here has been sort of an interesting trajectory. I'm a basic neuroscientist by training, so very interested in how developing brains get wired up with such precision very early on in development. And so that's a field that I've followed now peripherally, but over the course of 25 years. After I did my postdoc work, I decided to take a risk as a young scientist, and I took a policy fellowship at the Department of State, where I started to work on AIDS as a foreign policy issue, and that really changed the course of my career. I went to the National Institutes of Health after that and spent most of my career leading global health programs and developing global health programs on things like AIDS and emerging diseases and maternal and child health, those sorts of issues, working with partners around the world. And so after 20 years of federal service, I then led a nonprofit. And then I joined Cyclotherapeutics, which was at the time called CTD Holdings. And I joined this group. So now I'm in the private sector, in part because I wanted to have an experience working with patients and families. You know, sitting at NIH and giving grants to scientists is a fantastic undertaking, but working with patients and families is another. And I found that in this company, I'm very excited to have the opportunity to see the whole drug development process from the basic science all the way through to hopefully drug registration for our drug called Trapsol Cyclo. And I'll tell you more about that as we get into it. But that's a bit about me and how I've gotten here.
That's fascinating. And you've done quite a bit, and that now being in the space, you know, it's an interesting space to be in for sure. Can you tell me a bit about Niemann-Pick disease and what that is, how that's broken up? Because I understand there are different types of it. And can you just give a brief overview of it?
Sure. Well, Niemann-Pick disease is a rare, ultra-rare disease. Actually, it affects about 1 in 100,000 live births, Niemann-Pick type C. But there are, as you said, there are several types of this disease. So what is Niemann-Pick disease? It's a defect in how cells in our body process cholesterol. Cholesterol is actually very important for so many functions in our bodies. It's in cell membranes. It's the basis for a number of steroids. So cholesterol actually, you know, is sort of an underpinning of cellular functions. And so it's so important, and it's very tightly regulated. If we have too much cholesterol in our bodies, we get rid of it. If we don't have enough, we convert other things to it. It's so important to normal cell functioning. Historically, Niemann-Pick was discovered as a disease back in 1900 when a pediatrician noticed a child with an enlarged liver, an enlarged spleen, and neurologic symptoms. And then later, his name was Niemann, Albert Niemann. And then years later, a pathologist named Pick, Ludwig Pick, noted that the cells of these patients were just chock full of lipids. And so they named this sort of syndrome Niemann-Pick disease. But it wasn't until the 1960s at a lab at NIH, not the National Institutes of Health, led by Roscoe Brady, where we started to understand Niemann-Pick A, type A, Niemann-Pick type B, which is a defect in an enzyme in the lipid manufacturing process. So acid sphingomyelinase is the name of the enzyme, and a defect there causes this accumulation of glycolipids, so lipids with sugars on them. Later on, a scientist named Peter Penchev discovered Niemann-Pick type C, which is different from A and B. So Niemann-Pick type C is a defect in a protein which is very large and in the membrane of the lysosome. And that protein, in 95% of cases, is responsible for the accumulation of cholesterol in the lysosome of the cell. And that is the defect in Niemann-Pick disease. So it's a defect in which cholesterol gets basically stuck, trapped in the cells, can't get out. So what does that look like from a clinical perspective? So the disease can be detected at various stages in the lifespan, usually in childhood, sometimes in infancy, and those children do not survive for long. There's a type in which toddlers will manifest the symptoms first. Those patients will tend to survive until the age of 10 to 14. And then there's sort of later onset versions of it. Most patients will unfortunately succumb to the disease before the age of 20. But for those who present with symptoms in their 20s or sometimes up to 50 or 60 years old, those patients can live for decades with varying amounts of disability. So this is a progressive disease. Patients will die prematurely from Niemann-Pick disease. And it's the onset of the neurologic symptoms, which sort of defines which type they fall into so that patients and families can expect what might happen. Now, there are liver, lung, and spleen issues as well, because remember, every cell in the body is having cholesterol stuck in it. And so there are other, in addition to the neurologic dysfunction, there are other manifestations of the disease. So this is what we call a systemic disease. And therefore, we're looking for systemic treatments of it that will be able to touch the peripheral organs as well as the brain and the neurologic manifestations of the disease.
You mentioned that it has a variety of different manifestations and symptoms. Just to sort of flesh out what these patients are going through, can you just speak more to the quality of life for these patients? Sort of what does their, I guess, day-to-day life look like in dealing with this, whether they have it early onset, they develop it later on, just to give more, I guess, flesh to this condition?
Sure. You know, this is what's called a hypervariable disease. So the presentation is heterogeneous. And that's because, again, this MPC1 protein is very large. So the genetic defect can be in any number of places. There are, you know, hundreds of different mutations for the disease. So it's hypervariable. Even siblings with MPC1 can present somewhat differently with the disease. So it's hard to say what's a typical presentation, but what I can say is that it's a progressive, debilitating disease. For families who receive the diagnosis of NPC for a loved one, it's really a devastating diagnosis to receive because there are no cures and there's only one treatment available. I'll come to that later. It's available in Europe and not approved in the U.S. And again, we can speak more about that later. But patients tend to have, they'll start with the neurologic symptoms can be minor at first, you know, a certain kind of gaze palsy, vertical supranuclear gaze palsy, which means that the patient just can't move his or her eyes up and down, they move their head. And this is one of the signals that pediatricians will often detect, this unusual gaze palsy. It's one of the first neurologic symptoms that appears. But otherwise, patients, say in toddlerhood or early childhood, will start to trip and fall unusually. So they may be running normally, and then they'll start to become a little bit clumsy. And so that's a sign that the motor skills, you know, are starting to be affected. There are challenges with swallowing, which again, these will get progressively worse without intervention. And so patients tend to, over time, use food thickeners and find other adaptive devices to help them eat, weighted spoons, these kinds of things, because motor skills can be affected. Cognition can be affected in many patients. And this can start even after children are in high school. They can be developing seemingly normally and then start to have challenges, say at 14 or 15, which are often go misdiagnosed as ADHD or other kinds of behavioral problems, and then only to discover years later that they have this underlying genetic disease. So the disease is progressive. Patients and families tend to adapt as they can with assistive devices for walking, for swallowing, fine motor skills, these kinds of adaptations that can be made.
When we talk about rare diseases and just really any disease, there are certain diseases or conditions that tend to affect a particular population. Is that the same case with Niemann-Pick disease, that a certain population tends to have this disease, or does it just affect anyone and everyone?
Yeah, it is called pan-ethnic. So every population group has Niemann-Pick disease, but like other genetic diseases, it does tend to be amplified in communities in which there's consanguinity, so intermarriage among some distant cousins. Genetic defects tend to be amplified in those communities. So where those cultural practices are observed, for example, in the Middle East, the prevalence of Niemann-Pick disease can be higher than in other places, in certain communities in India, and communities that tend to segregate and to be very close-knit. Now, the carriers, so in order to have Niemann-Pick disease, a patient has to have a defect in both genes. So it's a 1 in 4 chance of having the disease. It's autosomal recessive, it's called. Now, carriers do not seem to have symptoms. And this is why Niemann-Pick disease really can occur anywhere, because the carriers do not know that they are carrying this genetic defect because they have only one copy of the defective gene and their Niemann-Pick protein is somewhat functional.
So can you speak more to how the screening and diagnostic practices work for this disease? What does it look like? And
yeah,
just kind of flesh that out a bit more.
Sure. I'll talk about it historically, because I like to look at the history of how things developed. And again, I'll go back to Peter Pinchov way back in, you know, 1970, when he discovered the NPC1 or Niemann-Pick type C as a separate disease. He noticed, again, that these cells, it was in a spontaneous mouse model. And he noticed in these cells that the lysosomes, that compartment of the cell where there's a lot of, it's an action area for trafficking of proteins and things coming into and out of the cell. The lysosome was chock full of what he discovered was cholesterol. And that led to one of the diagnostic tools, which is used even today, although lesser so, for Niemann-Pick. It's called Philippin staining. And Philippin is just a molecule which fluoresces when it meets unesterified cholesterol. And that's the version of cholesterol that gets stuck in the lysosome. And so what they do is take skin biopsies and look at the fibroblasts under the microscope after staining them with this Philippin stain, and they'd see the cells bright blue and that they're chock full of cholesterol. And so the skin biopsy became really the mainstay of diagnosing NPC for decades. But then, of course, with the advent of molecular biology, now we can do genetics and confirm the NPC1 diagnosis that way. So diagnosis is becoming easier when clinicians suspect Niemann-Pick disease. And actually, that's an important qualifier. A physician has to think that a patient might have a lysosomal storage disease and it might be NPC in order to send them for the genetics to confirm. That process, as physicians become more aware of Niemann-Pick as a disease, that process is becoming more common. But there are many of the patients and families with whom we've spoken over the years note that their diagnostic journey can take 5 years on average of misdiagnosis, underdiagnosis. During all that time, they've been trying different things which haven't been working, the patient's deteriorating, and ultimately they will receive this diagnosis of NPC, which is at least it's good information to have. They know what to expect and can start to prepare, but their diagnostic journey can be very long and very painful for families.
Yeah, I'm sure. And just talking in previous episodes, it seems like when it comes to rare diseases that a lot of patients have to go through this long journey of just not being sure exactly what they have and then, you know, being finally diagnosed later in life. And then that's a whole nother sort of burden unto itself. It's, you know, I can imagine sort of the burden for these patients and their families.
You know, many physicians tell us that they've learned about Niemann-Pick disease in medical school, but have never seen a case because it's so rare. And so, you know, there's a lot of learning that goes on.
Right. Education is the aspect, and that's what's tied to the last question I'll ask. But right now, let's switch over to research and treatment. I'll sort of combine my two questions here. Kim, you speak to the current state of treatment, sort of where we are now with that. And then I think that's then we can segue into new research. Well, yeah. So can you just talk about like current state?
Sure. The patients with Niemann-Pick disease are treated symptomatically. So as these symptoms appear, they are treated and followed and tracked. So in rich countries, in developed countries, patients tend to have teams of doctors working with them and occupational therapists. So they're assessed often for their ability to walk. Do they need a wheelchair? Do they need food thickeners, assistive devices? Like some patients wear weighted vests to help them maintain their stability, you know, so that they can walk more smoothly. So, and then there are behavioral issues and sleeping medication and, you know, all kinds of neurologic treatments for the various symptomologies that come on with the disease. So patients tend to be treated symptomatically. Now there is one approved drug in Europe, not in the United States, called miglustat or zavesca. And that blocks this enzyme, the acid sphingomyelinase enzyme. So it's a substrate reduction kind of therapy. So it reduces the glycosphingolipids across the board. That was approved in Europe, but it was not approved in the United States. It is approved in the United States for Gaucher's disease. And so patients in the U.S., if they have access, if their insurance will cover it, or if they have access to the drug through other means, they will often use it. this other drug. Now that drug does not, and now we'll segue a little bit into the research, because that drug works on neurologic symptoms, but does not help every patient. And then there are some side effects that patients don't tolerate well. So not every patient that has access to it uses that drug for long term. So there really is a need for more therapeutic interventions in this space. So in terms of then clinical research, our company is working on Trapsol-Cyclo as our product, and that drug has a particular affinity for cholesterol. Our drug captures this unesterified cholesterol in the core. So the molecule itself looks like a donut. That's how we describe it in 3D. And the unesterified cholesterol, the sort of bad actor here, gets stuck in the core of our molecule and then can be carried out of the lysosome. So in effect, it acts like that faulty NPC1 protein. It replaces the function and allows cholesterol to move normally through the cell. So that's how our drug works. So we've completed a phase 1 trial, a phase 2 trial, and we have launched and are enrolling in our phase 3 trial now. And we've started in the United States. We give our drug intravenously, so the audience will be interested in that. It's a relatively long infusion, 6.5 hours. But for those patients who feel benefit, 6.5 hours every 2 weeks is, something that they're willing to undergo for sure. Our phase 1 trial showed very favorable safety profile and showed that our drug removes cholesterol from cells. And so we talk about that further maybe another time. But we have this wonderful biochemistry and histology, which actually shows that we clear cholesterol from cells. But in our phase 2 study, complemented that study and showed that very promising signals of efficacy, including neurologic. So, those are the two trials which brought us right to where we are right now with our phase 3 trial. And we're very excited. We have the largest, the most advanced NPC trial in the world right now. And we need 93 patients for full enrollment. And we have a rock solid protocol, which we've worked on very carefully with regulators, both in the United States and Europe and other countries. And so we're excited to be moving forward. And we believe that we'll be able to get our drug over the finish line and really help this patient community. You asked about the landscape, and I do want to note that there have been a couple of other fails in this space recently in the last year or so. And, this is devastating for the NPC community. Clinical research is hard, and patients really sacrificing their families quite a lot to participate in clinical trials. And if the trial fails for whatever reason, it's a blow for everyone in the space. We want to see options for patients. This is a heterogeneous disease. We want patients to have multiple options. That's why we're so excited about where we are right now with our own progress.
I'm excited to see what the future holds for this. To kind of wrap up, for these patients, well, let's say for the physicians and clinicians, what advice would you give to them when it comes to seeking more educational opportunities, resources? We talked about a little bit about that at the beginning. Are you aware of any particular advocacy groups, educational groups that could be a resource to physicians looking to learn more about this disease?
Oh, that's a great question. And thank you for that. Because I wanted to talk a little bit about physicians first. There's some real heroes in this space, including Dr. Caroline Hastings, who works very closely with us and was the first physician in the United States to give this drug on a compassionate basis to patients. That's where this whole story began. And with Dr. Benny Liu as well, who did the animal studies, he's also working with us. Physicians who are involved in clinical research, we have to remember they also have clinical practices. Many of them teach. They have many, many responsibilities, and they go the extra mile to participate in clinical research. And I think we all owe them a great debt of gratitude. I really think of them as heroes and champions. And I just mentioned two of them, but there are many, many more physicians who treat patients with rare disease do our whole community a world of good by through their work. So I give a shout out to the physicians. Now, there are ways, you know, there are networks of physicians, of course, just like there are networks of families. When there's a new diagnosis in the United States or in other countries, thanks to social media, families find each other and they learn from each other. And that's terrific. They ask each other, you know, everything about the journey and what to expect. Same for physicians. There are communities of physicians who, you know, share information. Dr. Hastings shares her vast experience with anybody. We've sent many physicians to her. But there are advocacy groups, and this is really important. There are organized groups who work to advocate on behalf of NPC families. In the United States, we work very closely with the National Knee and Pick Disease Foundation, NNPDF. And in the UK, there's a very well-organized group, NPUK, same thing there. And there are others around the world. There's actually an umbrella organization called the International Knee and Pick Disease Alliance, which has the national organizations as their members. And so they help these advocacy organizations, you know, come up to speed. They share best practices. We work with all of them. And you know, to talk about our trial, to be sure that patients understand what opportunities are available to them, and also to invite physicians to join our trials as sites and to work with us. So we're excited for that patient contact, that physician contact, and certainly for the really important work that the advocacy organizations do on behalf of all of us.
You know, I realized I never explicitly asked, what kinds of physicians tend to work with patients with Niemann-Pick disease? What does that care team look like?
It actually varies country to country, so it is interesting. In the UK, as an example, there's because of their national health system, they have reference centers for Niemann-Pick patients. So once a patient receives a diagnosis from their pediatrician or other primary care provider, they are followed through one of these reference centers across the UK, which is why the UK has such good numbers, is able to track patients really across the UK, and that's terrific. In the United States, it's a little bit more diverse and heterogeneous. So pediatricians, of course, will follow patients or adult primary care providers, along with metabolic storage experts. So there are metabolic experts. There are clinical geneticists who will follow patients. There are, for the older onset patients, those who are diagnosed in their 50s and 60s, they tend to be diagnosed by psychiatrists. And so those folks tend to present with psychiatric symptoms that can't be treated through other standard therapies. And then the psychiatrist may think, maybe this is Niemann-Pick disease or some other lysosomal storage disease, and then we'll do the genetic test to find out. So it really is an array of clinicians involved. And that's because, again, of the heterogeneity of the disease and the time in life when it may present itself.
Well, Dr. Rinko, this has been a wonderful 30 minutes. Thank you so much for your time to talk about this.
Thank you, Jonathan, very much for having me and for giving us the opportunity.
Stay tuned for the next Rare Disease Report. I'm your host, Jonathan Alisea. Thank you for listening.